Hey guys, you're listening to Unlimited Hangout. I'm your host, Whitney Webb. I'm really happy to be back after a long hiatus. If you follow me on Rockfin or are subscribed to my email list, you'll be aware of why I was away. If not, I would direct you to those relevant updates if you'd like to know more. I'd been hoping to be back a little sooner, but unfortunately demands were being made that my 3.5-year-old daughter be COVID tested in order to continue going to her daycare. So she ended up being home for most of the last 2 weeks because I chose not to do that for various reasons. Of course, in the time since I've been away, a lot has happened. One thing that I've been eager to discuss for some time has been this relatively recent steady promotion of a UFO narrative that is being almost exclusively created and promoted by the CIA, other intelligence agencies, the U.S. military, and neoconservative figures like Marco Rubio, James Woolsey, and others. I'm once again joined by Robbie Martin of the Very Heavy Agenda and the Media Roots podcast to unpack what these very organizations and figures stand to gain from promoting this narrative and how it all ties back to old neoconservative ambitions to completely militarize space in order to secure American military hegemony through the 21st century and beyond. So really, since last April, the promotion of the plausibility of UFOs has been steadily growing in the mainstream and becoming almost impossible not to notice in the lead up to a U.S. government report on these very topics due out later this month, at least to Congress anyway. Though much hasn't been revealed yet about the report itself, the window has been open about the role of potentially extraterrestrials or Russia and China as being behind the UFO phenomena. It's important to point out that the information regarding the report and those incidents that have been covered by the media in the lead up to its completion have come almost entirely from either the U.S. intelligence community or the U.S. military. And of course, followers of my work will know how I feel about that last point, as the last people I take at face value are the U.S. military and U.S. intelligence, and that's certainly the case here. So, Robbie, it's always great to have you back on. So I'd like to start asking you your impressions, what they've been of this recent ratcheting up about the UFO narrative and the people behind it.
Well, thanks for having me on, Whitney. It's kind of hard to know where to start, but I guess I'll just start chronologically, not going back too far, but this recent rollout appears to have really started with a New York Times article from last year that basically was the first mainstream media article that I know of that actually had contained in it footage claiming to be from the U.S. military photographing some kind of UFO. Or as they now call them, UAP. I don't even know what the acronym actually is.
I think it's Unidentified Aerial Phenomena is what UAP is supposed to be. Yeah.
So then, you know, that article kind of made some buzz. It didn't, it had, you know, a lot of people were excited about it. A lot of people were weirded out by it. I was weirded out by it when I saw it. I remember watching the footage and thinking, now this is really odd that this would even come out of the New York Times. And then, you know, I kind of forgot about it. And then about a year later, which was like, I think like 2.5 weeks ago from the time we were recording this, one of the most, you know, esteemed news programs in the country, 60 Minutes, does an entire segment about it and presents it all very, very seriously. And in this segment, it was revealed that Christopher Mellon, the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Intelligence in the Pentagon, actually acknowledges and takes credit for being this sort of heroic whistleblower inside the Pentagon who wanted to get this stuff out there, you know, and leaked these videos to the New York Times. And then we have Luis Elizondo, who's featured very, you know, all over the 60 Minutes special. He's kind of this, he almost seems like some kind of UFO crank, you know, conspiracy guy, but he was in the Pentagon, supposed to be this guy who was, you know, this guy who was really trying to rattle all the cages in the Pentagon and really tell people this is serious, we need to investigate this. And he was sort of laughed at and whatnot. And this is sort of how the story was presented. But I thought the most compelling thing, at least in the 60 Minutes special for me, and this is sort of, you know, this is just my gut reaction to it, was that I think my gut reaction to it was that at least two of the people in the special, two of these Air Force pilots, were either telling the truth about what they saw, or they're extremely good actors, like Oscar quality actors. So I tend to believe their eyewitness accounts, but at the same time, Whitney, I'm very much in line with your thinking on what this rollout really is about. And it does seem to be sort of a roundabout way to push for you know, some kind of increase in militarization of space. But what I find really interesting about this way this has been rolled out is it has the appearance of being some kind of patriotic insiders inside the state who are trying to rattle the cages in the government and you know, really wake people up. And this is almost kind of like a populist narrative in a way. It's like, it's not, you know, Joe Biden's not getting up there at the podium and saying, we now admit there's UFOs and they're a threat or whatever. It's almost has this appearance, almost like the way the lab leak theory about Wuhan has sort of reemerged. It has this sort of false appearance of being something that whistleblowers got out there, and now the media has no choice but to talk about it. Now, I think that's all sort of an illusion that we've been, you know, that's part of the propaganda rollout. And I think that's the way that most of these sort of disinformation operations work now, is they are done in a sort of a limited hangout way where it's like, oh, check out this whistleblower who's a threat. You know, the government's trying to shut him down, but now we have no choice but to cover this. But I mean, I guess I just got to say the most remarkable and most, I think most crazy thing about this, that 60 Minutes would air this, is that this is the first time in history that I know of, at least in American culture, that all of a sudden, just on a dime, the news media is like, okay, now this is serious. Like before, it was always kooky, it was silly. It's like, let's, you know, we're going to talk about this story for you, but we're not going to say that we believe in it or anything. And now the difference in tone is like remarkably, you know, it's very different. It's like,
yeah.
So that to me is odd. It's not organic. I don't think just because some of these news media people saw this video that's supposedly of a UFO from the military, they all of a sudden were convinced, you know, something else is happening here. And that's sort of, I mean, I'm imagining that's part of what we're going to talk about, is like what's really happening underneath this. But, you know, at the same time, Whitney, like I personally do think, you know, some of these eyewitness accounts over time are credible. Now, that doesn't mean that I think that, you know, there's not something fishy going on or funny going on here. It's just that there's something more to this that I think we, you know, probably should unpack for people, because it's just so many facets to it.
Well, you know, Navy pilots and their eyewitness stuff is one thing, right? But the people that are really driving this narrative and have given it quote unquote mainstream credibility have been a lot of former CIA directors recently talking about this on record, like John Brennan, James Woolsey, among others. Wow. Yeah. And actually, James Woolsey talked about it pretty recently on his book tour, where he's claiming that John F. Kennedy was killed by the Kremlin. And then goes on to talk about, you know, oh, I think UFOs are credible now and all of this stuff. So it's being driven by people like that. Also, Barack Obama's come out and made claims. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that once he came out and said that's kind of amps it up to a degree that, you know, even you could have like five CIA directors coming out and saying it wouldn't move the needle. But Obama coming out and saying it's like, what the fuck?
Yeah. Well, you also have Marco Rubio, who I don't know if he still is, but he was in December when some of this stuff was going on, head of the Senate Intelligence, or acting head of the Senate Intelligence Committee. And then you have Harry Reid coming out and talking about how he's believed in UFOs this whole time, but he was told not to talk about it publicly until now, which is a little odd. So, you know, there's this consensus among the power structure that it's okay to talk about it now. And I think that's why the mainstream media is acting that way. And that's really concerning, that quote unquote conspiracy theories are only mainstream credible if the intelligence community and very obviously compromised politicians say it's okay to talk about. Because obviously those forces only do that when it's in their best interest. And I think, you know, going back to the Navy pilot point, I think, you know, there's been a lot of pilots and stuff that have said a lot of things over the years, and a lot of it is likely credible in those cases. But I think only now they're using those to their advantage for part of this broader agenda.
100%. I mean, it's that's what's so fascinating about it, is what you said is really, I think, cuts through all this stuff, is that all of a sudden the public is starting to take this seriously because intelligence officials and like mainstream media have like told people it's okay, essentially, psychologically.
Yeah. And that's scary that they're the people that determines what's credible and what's not to the American public, just because of, you know, their track record alone, you know, is just scary enough. But this report that a lot of this buzz has come from recently, that's supposed to, be unclassified to the public at some point, and it's going to be given to Congress and all of this stuff. It's not, it's being developed by the Pentagon, but in coordination with the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, who leads the whole intelligence community. So it's the Pentagon and the intelligence community together authoring this. And I mean, anyone that thinks they're going to tell the truth about this issue, you know, I would consider you naive, no offense. It's a little concerning to me that people would just take this this whole push at face value, but it really has apparently anyway had an impact. 2 days ago, Newsweek reported on a survey that said 43% of Americans are now more interested in aliens after the Pentagon UFO report, because, you know, allegedly because of the New York Times reportings on some of these early findings from it, they left the door open about whether extraterrestrials or aliens are involved in the UFOs or not. And there's really only two camps that these, you know, national security figures and politicians have left open as explanations. One is that the UFOs are extraterrestrial in origin, and the other is that the UFOs are Russia and China. It has to be one or the other, which is pretty concerning when you look at it through the lens of this is being used to push for a longstanding agenda about militarizing space.
And Whitney, I just thought of something that I think is really crucial to this. And I know this is just like a real-time pontification, but look at what's happened during the Trump era. The mainstream media's credibility plummeted down to the floor. Almost no one, you know, other than if you're a lib, you know, generic lib, almost no one trusts the mainstream media anymore. That Overton window, it's like it's shifted so strongly during the Trump era that you have to imagine on some level that this, whatever this is, this UFO rollout, it's the first time that I've seen in a long time people in a bipartisan fashion getting excited and believing the mainstream media. That like, oh, the mainstream media is reporting on this, this must mean it's true. That's one of the first bipartisan like beliefs in that I've seen maybe since before Trump. And that to me is really interesting, because on some level, you know, QAnon and that whole phenomenon kind of increased people's distrustingness of mainstream media. You know, whether, you know, I'm not saying that was a net result, a good thing that QAnon did. I'm just saying that's what happened. And it's sort of odd that that was used as a vehicle by whoever, to, you know, to cause all this chaos. And it involved a lot of conspiracy theories from conspiracy culture. And it was sort of, you know, in part designed to undermine the mainstream media. And then now here we have the mainstream media pushing out a very strong and powerful sort of conspiracy folklore mythology thing about UFOs and gaining all this power again in a weird way. So I find that very psychologically interesting. And I do think that might have something to do with what we're seeing here. You know, I totally agree with you on the Space Force stuff, but there is a psychological component to this that's very interesting to me.
Yeah, that is a really good point to raise, because it definitely has sort of brought people back into the fold of mainstream media, I think, to an extent, because it's like, oh, this is so unusual for them to report on. Ergo, there must be something true to this. I think is the effect it's having. And if you look at, you know, what some people think to be, you know, some of the origins of what's later spawned QAnon, like Cass Sunstein's paper on, you know, infiltrating conspiracy movements. Well, you know, if you're going to infiltrate conspiracy movements to make them love government instead of distrust government, you can also infiltrate the mainstream with conspiracy talking points to, you know, meet specific goals as well. So, I mean, these people obviously consider that stuff. And having seen the appeal of alternative media addressing so-called forbidden truths, or, you know, in the case of QAnon, going, you know, into different, you know, topics of in conspiracy land and whatnot, the success that had in drawing people's attention. I mean, maybe they saw this as a way to, you know, not just resuscitate mainstream media, but also, you know, push for different agendas and have just a larger psyop on the general public. So
it could almost be seen, you know, whatever the meat of this actually is, whatever other purposes it serves, it could almost be seen as like a trial balloon rollout. It's like, can we get people hooked on our own version of a conspiracy narrative? And in a way they successfully have, and it's bipartisan. So that's another sort of interesting aspect to it. I mean, that's, I think, really notable, because the media is really unable to do that with almost anything else. This, in a weird way, gives them the power to do that. I'm not saying that's the complete intent behind it, but it's definitely, I mean, it does give them an incredible amount of power and new credibility in a strange way.
Well, also, you know, if the alien aspect or hostile alien aspect is, or the fact that a foreign adversary has really advanced technology, if that's introduced as an explanation for these things at some point, you know, that will definitely stoke a lot of fear that the government, I think, will take advantage of for various reasons, and to get people that currently aren't falling in line to fall in line. Because how else do we combat such a massive threat as this without, you know, the U.S. military behind us and all of this stuff? You know, I think that's worth considering as well.
And also the old, I mean, let's go back to the classic psychological paradigm here of, you know, almost like the day the Earth stood still, the concept that if aliens came to visit Earth, it would somehow end all of our internal conflicts with each other. We would be looking outward in fear rather than looking at each other in fear.
Yeah, and humanity would unite against the common enemy of the alien or whatever. Yeah, yeah, people
that's
have
like
posited
culturally.
This.
That's culturally been baked into our, you know, pop culture forever. I mean, The Watchmen, you know, has a sort of a, there's a component of it that's all about that. So,
well, yeah, and video games too.
Yeah.
Mass Effect being one. Mm-hmm.
So I do think that could also be used. You know, this could pivot, and it already is. Some people are already doing it to be about Russia and China. Are they behind this? But it could also pivot to being something like what I just mentioned, where it's a psychological ploy in some way to get us just to completely, you know, focus our attention on something else. Like if they can convince us that these things are just a threat to humanity and that's the line, then that could also have a powerful, you know, impact on the way that we think about the world and other countries and whatnot.
Yeah. Yeah. I tend to agree with that. And also another point I wanted to bring up is that, the investigators behind this report, remember, they're the military and the intelligence community writing this, right? They have allegedly ruled out the possibility that the UFOs have any relation to secret U.S. military or intelligence technology or black programs of either. And it's pretty interesting that people would believe anything the Pentagon or the intelligence community would say about their own black budget programs. I think that's kind of silly to take on face value. And I think it also just shows that there's like a lot of public ignorance about the fact those programs even exist. So for example, if you have Navy pilots talking about credible things that are really weird, they certainly wouldn't be privy to know the information of what's researched and what has been developed through those programs, for example. And, you know, I mean, there's some really crazy technology that was obviously developed by these programs a long time ago that's being commercialized now. So as in one example, there's an Israeli company that now advertises that they can beam sound into your head with a device. You don't have to wear headphones. And once that type of technology like reaches commercial market, it's been around for a long time. And that type of technology tends to be developed by groups like DARPA or the CIA or their equivalents in other countries. So, you know, the fact that that's been commercialized now means that every intelligence agency in the whole world has access to that type of technology now. And so, you know, oh, you know, if there's some sort of thing about aliens speaking telepathically to people and all of this stuff, you know, it's really important that we know the type of technology the military has been trying to work on and all of this stuff before people just give in to the awe factor that is being sort of woven into this whole UFO narrative here. I don't actually know if they're going to try and roll out the alien thing or not, or just keep it mysterious, but sort of frame the UFOs as threatening without saying what their source is. I think that's probably more likely. But, you know, there's a lot of, this could get really crazy. It really depends on where they want to take this. And I don't really want to say that I know what's going to happen there. But I think, you know, the fact of the matter, whether even real aliens get rolled out or not, the intelligence community and the military, they're not going to tell us the truth if there is stuff like that around. They've known about it for some time. They just didn't tell people. So much of this stuff has been classified for years. And obviously, you know, all these conspiracy theories popped up from something at some point, whether it was, you know, secretive U.S. national security community technology or something else. I don't think we should trust these people to tell us what's what on an issue that's going to be so sensational and have such lasting impacts.
Of course. And just in case anybody's listening who wasn't following the way this is rolled out, I mean, basically what Whitney's talking about is this: they released a report, right after the 60 Minutes special, trying to, claiming they were going to investigate it. And one of the most interesting omissions in the report is it basically says we don't know what these are. So it says it's not U.S. technology. It's not our stuff. And we don't know what it is. That inherently creates the perception that it's something really threatening and dangerous, because if the U.S. military doesn't know what it is, then that means that it's a threat to them. Automatically, you can make that logical leap. And I think that that's part of what this is designed to do. It's not like they're saying, they don't even have to say, these craft move way faster than anything we have. They could outmaneuver us. They can attack us, and then we wouldn't be able to respond. It's just the mere fact that these craft can move faster than military jets alone implies that. So they don't even need to really say that yet. It's like, I can kind of boil the frog a little bit right now and just let people think that themselves. Because if you just watch that video, even though these military pilots sound like excited and they're like laughing, they're like, oh my God, like we got this thing on, we're tracking it. Like they're all like, having this like crazy time, on some level, people watching that know that it is an inherently threatening thing that they're trying to show us, that the military, can't even outmaneuver these things. So that's, so that needs to be understood too, mm-hmm. that there's an underlying message there that's already there.
Absolutely. And actually there's a quote from this that was in an ABC News report a week ago. The quote comes from Mick Mulroy, who is now an ABC News contributor, but was formerly a CIA officer and also a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense. It's funny how so many of these like ex-spooks, ex-military people are now regular contributors to mainstream news. But anyway, he told ABC this has to be investigated because, quote, these objects appear to exceed our military capabilities. And he goes on to say, we need to determine who this is and what capabilities they possess. It is never a good thing to discover you are vastly behind in technology. From a national security perspective, we cannot presume benevolence, whether terrestrial in origin or not. So, So if you choose either of the two possible explanations that we're being told are the only possible explanations by these people, it's there needs to be a new military arms race of some type that's intimately tied to space, which is pretty wild. And in the wake of this, the release of these early findings of the Pentagon report, NASA, which is actually led by, I didn't realize this until I was preparing for this podcast, it's led by Bill Nelson now, who is like he's a former senator, longtime senator for Florida, but he's probably the only person in like U.S. politics that's as geriatric as Joe Biden. I'm put in charge of NASA. Anyway, he's directed researchers to study at NASA to study UFOs now as like an important focus in the wake of this hype about the Pentagon and intelligence community report. But it's interesting that the media is only calling it the Pentagon report, but not really, noting in the fine print basically that it's being done in coordination with the intelligence community, and it's actually going to be the intelligence community that gives the findings to Congress, not the Pentagon.
Yeah, I mean, it's just super obvious that there's a psychological warfare component to whatever this is.
Yes.
Regardless of where you land on, aliens or not, or if you believe in UFOs or not, this has to be, being used as a vehicle for some kind of psychological warfare geopolitically, but also domestically, like twofold. And one thing I think people need to go back to is this documentary that was made, I think it was made like 10 years ago, called Mirage Men. That's basically all about this one government agent named Richard Doty, I think his parents' name. He's a retired special agent. He worked for the United States Air Force Office of Special Investigation, and he was posing as a ufologist researcher. And he would basically, his job became to go undercover to UFO conventions and like UFO researcher groups and plant disinformation. And the reason behind doing this was to cover up or basically muddy the waters of people's awareness of advanced military technology. Mm-hmm. So that right there, we already have a very clear example, an admitted example of the Pentagon you know, obviously working in conjunction with some kind of Intel apparatus, was doing this for that purpose. So we already know that they've done that. And so if that was the purpose then, is that the purpose now? Is this some advanced military technology that we just, that is just so crazy we don't understand it? I mean, you know, we've already, and then what's strange to me, Whitney, too, is this is sort of coming at the same time as all this talk and rumors about potential microwave weapons that are being used to target our embassy officials. Now, a year and a half ago, it was like, they weren't saying microwave weapon. They were saying this is mysterious. We don't know what this is. It's a weapon, we think. But now they're actually in the headlines just straight up saying microwave weapons in mainstream media. I mean, so we've gone from basically thinking UFOs are kooky, only the domain of the fringe conspiracy theorists, and that also electronic direct targeting into your brain was the craziest, most schizophrenic, paranoid thing you could believe. And now both are being reported by mainstream media.
How freaking weird
is that?
Totally. And also, like, even like direct energy weapons and stuff, I think, fall into that category. They've gotten a lot more mainstream. There's been a lot more mainstream discussion about them, whereas there wasn't before.
And that,
you know, and I think that's just a testament to the fact that a lot of the technology, the capabilities that the national security state has, we don't know about. They don't admit until, you know, years after the fact. And, you know, they hide that stuff from people. And it's years ahead of where commercial technology is.
Absolutely. And I mean, there's so many weapons that the U.S. government has experimented with on record. They've tried to make hallucinogenic smoke grenades. I mean, we've already have things where we've done direct and energy weapons. But ultimately, Whitney, going back to my point about how it is inherently, you can just in your mind fill in the blanks that if these things can outmaneuver our Air Force, then already it's some kind of threat. Then already the United States is not the dominant force on this planet somehow. It automatically can lead to that thought. So that being said, what would you need to defeat that threat? You'd need weapons or a response that moves, can outmaneuver them, or can somehow go way faster than what we already have. And you mentioned directed energy weapon. That's one thing that we've already been talking about doing, which can do that, you know, can move at the speed of light or whatever. And then the other one is something that we've been actively talking about, and even the media has been reporting about at the same time as these UFO stories, and it's this idea of a hypersonic weapons arms race, weapons that can actually go 5 to 10 times faster than the speed of sound. And that, you know, it's like, well, in your head, it's like, well, what, how can we outmaneuver these mysterious craft? Well, you need hypersonic or weapons that just go extremely fast. And so it sort of plays directly into that. And that's also just really scary, you know, that if they're really making those, you know, that could be another, I don't even know if that's possible, but they're, you know, the military has been actively talking about hypersonic missiles forever. I don't know, like 10, 20
years. Well, I think another key component, a key policy goal here of the military and the intelligence community is to literally surround the Earth in low orbit satellites. And this is actually what SpaceX's Starlink is doing right now. And they openly have said, you know, for years that the goal of Starlink is to basically envelop Earth with broadband and transform the sky. But this has admitted military capabilities of allowing the military and the intelligence community to surveil basically the entire planet. And of course, they can say, oh, this way we can know where the UFOs are and all of this stuff. And we can see and observe all of the threats before they happen. And, you know, this really goes back to the Reagan era of we need weapons in space so that we can, you know, if the Soviet Union launches a missile, we can disable it from space and we can use our radars positioned in space to know when they're going to launch a nuke or launch an intercontinental ballistic missile, and we can disable it before it ever reaches the homeland, and all of this stuff. So now that's being applied instead of the boogeyman of the Soviet Union, I would argue, is being applied to the boogeyman of what are the UFOs? I mean, they could be Russia or China, or they could be something else. I don't even think they really have to define the source of the threat. They just have to make the UFOs themselves threatening enough to justify the money being poured into this. But, you know, it obviously has, a, you know, much broader implications than quote unquote fighting the or combating the UFOs or understanding better the UFO issue, because, you know, if you're going to basically blanket the planet in surveillance and basically be able to laser any point on the planet whenever you want, that is not the kind of power that the U.S. military, intelligence community, and their allies should have. I think that's pretty, should be pretty clear, but this is actually a pretty old agenda. I don't know if you want to talk about, go into that yet, or if there's any more you want to say about the most current narrative push.
Well, yeah, before we go to that, if you don't mind, I just wanted to just go into the sort of the folklore aspect of how, you know, just what this plays on, especially sure. in American culture, because, you know, also it's like you don't have the Pentagon and all these little mainstream media reports don't even have to mention the possibility of actual extraterrestrial creatures or alien abductions or anything. It's all connected culturally for us already. We already have heard these stories thousands of times. The X-Files was all about, you know, the concept of the government working with aliens to, you know, enslave the population. It mixed all types of alien folklore things together kind of as a big mashup. So like that in of itself is really, I think for people who have certain people who have watched that special or who have read these stories, they're actually experiencing a deep sense of fear and uncomfortability that is almost like on the same, is almost akin to like believing that ghosts are real, their house is haunted. It transcends normal fears that people typically have about like real life tangible things. It's got this deep, you know, seated sort of cultural fear to it. The idea of alien abductions, I mean, even just for me personally, I mean, one of the scariest things I ever saw as a child, and it's really cheesy now to watch, but it was the movie Communion with Christopher Walken. And like, that scared the shit out of me as when I was like 8 years old when I saw that on TV. And I know I'm not alone in that. So like there's a very powerful psychological component to this. Mm-hmm. And what's also bizarre is I personally believe a few of these different stories that have been out there because there's just so many witnesses. And, you know, I don't know. I haven't taken the leap to think, oh, these are aliens visiting us, or this is really physically happening in front of these people. I tend to go in the direction of this is some kind of maybe even experimental technology to make people hallucinate, or, you know, if they're able to do microwave weapons to give people brain damage now, can you also create some kind of mass delusion? Can you induce a hallucination with a weapon of some kind? I mean, just for example, here's a very bizarre incident that is very hard to explain, that in 1994 in Zimbabwe, a school in a city called Rua, 30 students, or sorry, 60 students who went to this elementary school claimed that a UFO landed on their playground and that an alien came out of the UFO that they described as almost looking like a very skinny black stick figure of some kind. And it was telepathically beaming thoughts into their brain about how humans should stop polluting the earth. It all sounds very ridiculous and corny, but the craziest part is, about 30 years later, all these students who claim that they saw this still stick to their story. And, you know, what is that? Is that, you know, because that's almost completely different than what these U.S. Air Force pilots are reporting. That would almost have to be explained by, you know, if they didn't really see that, then it was some kind of hallucinatory event. How could 60 children, you know, hallucinate the same thing? It's such a strange thing. Very hard to explain. I mean, even the Fire in the Sky incident with Travis Walden, you know, this famously book written about it called Fire in the Sky, you know, that was 7 witnesses who saw that. And, you know, most of them, I think, except for one, passed lie detector tests because the guy, Travis Walden, while he was supposedly abducted, the police did a real investigation because they thought his coworkers murdered him during this logging job that they were doing. But in fact, they, you know, they claim they saw him be abducted by a UFO into the sky. Like unexplainable technology. I mean, what are these incidents? Is this just all people making this stuff up? Or is this experimental government technology? I mean, these are to me the things that, you know, not just make me, you know, kind of chilled, but also, you know, like just make me curious about what is actually going on here.
Yeah. Well, those stories, the last ones you mentioned, I can't really, you know, comment on beyond what you already brought up. But what I will say about how this has been this mythology and these different aspects of UFOs and aliens, how they've been seeded in sci-fi, in movies and television. It's important to keep in mind that the military and also the CIA have greatly influenced a lot of coverage about this stuff over the years.
X-Files included.
Exactly. And even, you know, talking about things targeting kids, like actually Disney, their whole Imagineering department in the 1990s was run by a guy that was at the same time doing on a defense advisory board for the Pentagon, got a CIA Medal of Recognition and brought on a bunch of people that had previously been DARPA contractors that also had ties to Jeffrey Epstein, of all people, to come and basically advise the Imagineering department of how to sell a lot of this futurist technology that we're seeing rolled out now to children through like Tomorrowland exhibits and different things during that period and movies and things like that. So, you know, this is definitely something that's been very far reaching. It makes you wonder if what's going on now, you know, it has been in the works for a really long time. I know that the space militarization thing certainly has been, but in terms of where they steer this, it is worth considering that maybe there were some people that always planned to have it steered this way at some point. Though I don't really, you know, we won't really know that until we end up seeing where this whole crazy narrative and, you know, how it plays out. You know, we'll have to see how things turn out down the line to really truly know more about that. But it definitely is a possibility.
Well, yeah, I mean, and, you know, just going back to Mirage Man for a second, it does seem like this is something that the government has attempted multiple times throughout the years. I mean, I know a lot of people in the UFO community think Robert Lazar is, you know, totally credible and that he's telling the truth. But like, you know, the things he said sound pretty over the top. I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with his claims, Whitney, but mm-mm. He's claimed that he worked at Area 51 and actually operated, you know, confiscated alien craft and all this stuff. And he's somehow very, very credible. He's actually directly associated with one of the documentary filmmakers who's partially responsible for getting all this stuff, you know, media attention, like on Joe Rogan and stuff for the past couple of years. So, I mean, that's a particularly interesting figure because, you know, he has not only pushed this idea that UFOs are real, but he's connected it also directly to like the gray alien thing, you know, from like the X-Files.
Yeah. I do want to bring up, though, the competing theory about Area 51, that it's been used to experiment on soldiers really heavily, a lot of soldiers have been poisoned there, that it's really heavily contaminated with different things, which may explain some of the different phenomena observed there. I mean, you know, obviously, we don't really know. I mean, the U.S. Senate even acknowledged its existence until 2013. It, of course, has, you know, this whole mythos of UFO about it, but it's worth asking if that is, you know, a ploy to make people think it's an interesting place instead of a hellish and scary and terrifying place.
Well, the burn pits, there was a famous court case where they basically, it was like a really interesting and bizarre court case. Actually, Jonathan Turley was on the side of the people filing this lawsuit against the U.S. military for getting cancer from burn pits at Area 51. So other than just human experimentation that they may be doing there, they're just doing horrible things environmentally that they don't even care if the soldiers, you know, get.
That's very common at all military bases, though.
But I do think that there is something interesting about Area 51, but maybe that's where they're doing some of the most awful stuff in that regard, because, you know, the EPA wasn't even allowed to come in after that court case to check to see if they were, you know, like, so the fact that they're not even allowed in there, I think, you know, who the fuck knows what they're up to?
Well, you know, keep in mind, too, that like the CIA and the intelligence community, they have, quote unquote, black sites. I mean, it would make sense that there would be a couple military bases that would serve that function as well. And Area 51 would seem sort of to fit that bill in a lot of ways. And what better way to cover up really shady stuff that goes on there by making people think, ooh, it's cool and mysterious, and that's where the aliens are, you know? I just think that would be a really effective tactic to cover up something else going on there. But again, who really knows? It's shrouded in mystery. Difficult to know exactly, but it is technically an Air Force base, I believe. Mm-hmm. And the Air Force, of course, before the creation of Space Force, was the most involved part of the military, you could say, in you know, space activities for obvious reasons. So, you know, it's possible, but
and they still operate the base in a very, very secretive way. That's almost like a spectacle. I mean, they bring people in like civilian clothing, have them like walk, you know, they have them take this unmarked plane to go into work. They don't even have, people don't even drive in like to go to Area 51. It's a very strange thing, but yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, this folklore, you know, and also it's, there's a lot of actual evidence that suggests that even just during the old early Cold War, that the US government was responsible for putting out a lot of this UFO propaganda in the first place with that, like Project Monarch or something, where there was like a disclosure back in the 60s or 70s. I mean, they've been up to this stuff for a long time, and it's like, who knows how much this narrative about aliens overall that we're familiar with is from the government. It's almost, you know, it almost becomes that much of a mind fuck in a way.
Yeah, it really is hard to know. And that's why it's always important, especially now that they're taking the narrative about it in this direction and seeding it in the mainstream so extensively, that people be more critical than ever of questioning what's going on and skeptical about what they're going to claim. And in the interest of time, if it's okay with you, I kind of want to get into sort of the longstanding agenda of why I think a lot of this is going on, which is about, you know, I touched on it a little bit earlier about different aspects about the militarization of space. And, you know, I talked a little bit earlier about the Reagan Star Wars stuff that was actually officially called the Strategic Defense Initiative. And there's a lot of different opinions about it. You know, it was largely framed as being basically a psychological operation about the Soviet Union. And it definitely did have that effect. But I think if you look at how Reagan first became interested in it, it was during a visit to Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. And he was talking to this physicist, Edward Teller. And basically what that briefing was about, that is credited with spawning or pushing President Reagan to create SDI, or the Star Wars program, was that Teller was telling him about directed energy weapons and lasers and microwave weapons specifically, which is interesting considering what we just talked about. And of course, all this was framed, SDI, the name in it, Strategic Defense Initiative, it was all framed as defense, but really it was this push to develop technology that didn't exist yet that was just totally insane at the time. And, you know, apparently, according to like George Saltz, who was Secretary of State under Reagan, he said that the meeting with Teller put a gleam in Ronald Reagan's eye and all of this stuff after being told about these insane weapons of death, basically. So I don't really buy that it was a defense thing. And I think once they realized, I think it might have been accidental, its use as a psyop against the Soviet Union, maybe once they realized how much it freaked out their counterparts in the Soviet Union, then they started to, you know, milk it for all it was worth. But when, you know, Reagan announced it, they gave the Soviet ambassador to the U.S. a heads up about it. And what he responded, how he responded was saying, you will be opening up a new phase in the arms race. And Reagan insisted that was not what the case was. It was about, you know, defense. And eventually they'd share the technology with Russia, and it would all be about defense and ending in nuclear weapons forever. But if you actually look into that first meeting that got Reagan interested in it, it was about how do we direct giant lasers at our enemies and eliminate them? I mean, it's like a very different than the official narrative. And so because of, you know, basically, you know, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of this technology didn't even exist. And it was kind of lampooned by experts at the time, because, you know, it was basically a policy intended to influence science. It wasn't science influencing policy, because that technology wasn't even around. And people didn't really even know how to invent it. But the same guy that this Edward Teller guy, the same guy that had sort of told all the, talked about all these doomsday weapons to Reagan in 1987, this is considered the crowning achievement of the Star Wars SDI program, was this effort to create small space launched missiles that was this program called Brilliant Pebbles. Mm-hmm. And basically that was launched in basically launched as a concept in 1987 and pursued, but production was set to begin in 1991 under Bush Senior. But it was actually eliminated or canceled and defunded under the Clinton administration in 1993 because of concerns it would violate missile treaties, which, of course, the Reaganites and neoconservatives weren't concerned about at the time. And surprisingly, the Clinton administration was. Maybe it's because they just wanted to, portray themselves as being, real change from the Reagan era and all this stuff. You know, it's really, I don't know exactly why they did it, but it definitely was a sore point for the neocons for years afterward. And going beyond that, I don't know if you want to comment before I get into this, but people may know about, well, probably if you listen to this podcast and you know about Robbie's work, you probably know about the Project for the New American Century, this neocon think tank in the late 90s and early 2000s. That's quite infamous for people that have ever researched 9/11 at all, because of, their new Pearl Harbor quote before 2000. Do you want to say a little bit about PNAC before I get into their space opinions?
Sure. I mean, I don't usually say this outright, but I'll say it on your podcast. I mean, I personally believe that some of the people who were associated with PNAC had some involvement in some fashion with 9/11 or the 2001 anthrax attacks. So it's always been a source of, obsession of mine, because it's one of the only think tanks where I think, the people in it and the things that they've said, in public and in their documents, it just seems a little bit too coincidental, if you know what I mean. And one of those, big things is the fact that they were basically asking for and desiring what they described as a new Pearl Harbor in one of their documents from 2000 called Rebuilding America's Defenses. And they got exactly what they wanted, which was a new Pearl Harbor in the form of the 9/11 attacks.
Yeah. And one thing I'd add to that is that a lot of the members or original signatories also, but it's worth keeping in mind that there's the original signatories of the PNAC, statement of principles, but then there's also people like John Bolton, for example, that later became associated with PNAC and signed multiple position papers and letters to presidents and Congress from PNAC, advocating for hawkish policies. And that's not just Bolton, but also like Richard Perle was another neocon that got involved with PNAC that way. Rebuilding America's Defenses, that was September 2000. And, after that was published and the Bush administration came into office, W. Bush, not Papa Bush, obviously, when he came into power, a significantly large amount of PNAC members were put into top positions in the executive branch in the Pentagon. So for people that aren't aware of those connections, I would encourage you to look at that. And some of the key people in that regard would be people like someone we mentioned earlier. Before I get to him, like Paul Wolfowitz was an original PNAC member. He was Deputy Secretary of Defense, very involved in the use of 9/11 for various, pushes like the Iraq War, among other things. Dov Zakheim, the Department of Defense comptroller, who was in charge of looking for the missing trillions of the Pentagon, announced the day before 9/11. And of course, the part of the Pentagon that was struck was the accounting office that was looking for that missing trillion, not actually a part of the Pentagon where top military planners were working. Donald Rumsfeld, who was himself U.S. Secretary of Defense, another original signer of PNAC Statement of Principles, Dick Cheney, Elliot Abrams, who was on the National Security Council, Scooter Libby, who was his chief of staff, Zalmay Khalilzad, who was basically put in charge of a lot of Iraq and Afghanistan stuff post-invasion, and who I believe is actually he was Trump's Afghanistan envoy, but I think he's actually still Biden's, that Biden kept him on, and he's still there. And then, of course, one of the key members on the 9/11 commission, John Lehman, another member of PNAC. And there's a lot more too. Members of the Defense Policy Board and the Bush Administration Defense Science Board, director of the Pentagon's Office of Special Plans, among other things, were all part of this PNAC thing. And what makes Rebuilding America's Defenses so significant is that the people that, in PNAC's view, this was all, they had this whole agenda of things that had to happen that were necessary and had to happen. Otherwise, the U.S. would lose its military hegemony to another country, Russia or China. And this couldn't happen at all. And they say the only way to avoid this being a lengthy process where we'll lose hegemony is, you know, the only way to prevent that is for basically a new Pearl Harbor to happen.
And I just wanted to mention that, you know, if people are skeptical of this idea that, you know, these people who signed these documents, you know, were deeply involved in creating the blueprints for all these, you know, the last 30 years of U.S.'s geopolitical plans, look to the actual document authors of Rebuilding America's Defenses, the people who contributed to this, you know, over 20-page document. It is Paul Wolfowitz, Scooter Libby, Robert Kagan, Fred Kagan, and interestingly, Donald Kagan's name is featured as one of the three main names who authored the document, the patriarch of the Kagan family. It's actually one of the only modern geopolitical like documents he's written like this. And then you also have Bill Kristol, who wrote the Rebuilding America's Defenses. So these people weren't just, you know, neocon pundits. They were involved in the actual blueprints for like the Bush era strategy of the war on terror, you know, the Iraq war, all that stuff.
Yeah. Well, Donald Kagan is listed officially as a project co-chairman. The other one is Gary Schmidt.
Yeah.
I'm not exactly sure who that is. But the main author is Thomas Donnelly, who I believe now is like a Giselle Donnelly or something. The trans neocon, which is interesting.
Really?
Yeah.
No,
you can
way.
Look it up.
No. Are you serious?
I'm totally serious.
That's fucking no way.
Just look it up. It's surprising to see a neocon, you know, but it's true. I did not make it up.
I am blown away. I had
Sorry to blow your mind.
Skip over that. We'll talk about that later.
Okay. Yeah. So anyway, so if you go to this document's pretty easy to find online still. So I would encourage you, if you're listening, to go and look it up and see this stuff for yourself. It's pretty crazy. If you go to the preface to Roman numeral 5, well, really Roman numeral 4, they list out their key findings, which is like a summary of the whole thing. And one of the key points is on the next page where that starts, which is Roman numeral 5. And one of the key things they highlight as the key things that have to happen is, quote, control the new international commons of space and cyberspace and pave the way for the creation of a new military service, the U.S. Space Force, with the mission of space control. Which is very interesting when we consider the fact that it was Trump. You had a bunch of neocons in his administration created Space Force. Pretty interesting. It was actually PNAC's idea, not an America First Trumper idea, to create Space Force. And it's all about the control of the international commons instead of sharing it with like the international community. It's about U.S. dominance of the international commons for specific reasons. And some of those reasons are really crazy, like denying countries they don't like use of space for commercial purposes, among other things. I mean, wow. We can get into that. But, you know, we talked about earlier about how the most famous quote from this PNAC document is the new Pearl Harbor quote. And that quote is actually nestled at the introduction to the part talking about the essential need to use that new Pearl Harbor, if it happens, to facilitate this huge pivot towards space and cyberspace, which I think is really significant because it brings up sort of this end game, I guess you could say, of what that was meant to be. And that is where we are now. So for people that have that want to see this for themselves in the document, there's different missions of space throughout the document, but this is the main section on it. It starts on page 50 and it's a section 5 called Creating Tomorrow's Dominant Force. And it starts with to preserve American military preeminence in the coming decades, the Department of Defense must move more aggressively to experiment with new technologies and operational concepts and seek to exploit the emerging revolution in military affairs. And they talk about how this is being led by technology and the U.S. has to lead this transformation or they will fall behind. And then, of course, it says the infamous quote, Further, the process of transformation, if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. And this is the exact section that they're talking about. And then it says, you know, these are the three new missions the armed forces must meet to maintain military preeminence, based on this strategy that, you know, will be super lengthy and take forever unless there's a new Pearl Harbor. And those are global missile defense, including ones that have space-based components, control of space and cyberspace. And then on that point, they say, much as control of the high seas and the protection of international commerce defined global powers in the past, so will control of the new international commons, meaning space and cyberspace, the internet, be a key to world power in the future. In America, incapable of protecting its interest or that of its allies in space or the, quote, infosphere, will find it difficult to exert global political leadership, which is pretty interesting.
Insane. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just so interesting, too, that we're in that end game right now. And it seems like, you know, the libs who are like anti-Trump are the ones who brought about this whole internet crackdown of the last 4 years that we've seen. That does seem to be some kind of deep state apparatus that is dominating cyberspace. It's like, well, they're making their move. And then on the other hand, the people who are dominating space or the apparatus that put the Space Force in was the Trump administration. So it's like these two goals in rebuilding America's defenses were, you know, arose out of the supposedly completely diametrically opposed forces.
Well, even in the case of like space from the commercial side and also the quote unquote infosphere, you know, both of those are being dominated right now by Silicon Valley figures and space. It's set to be Amazon and SpaceX, which is, of course, Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, and the infosphere, the internet, being dominated by, you know, companies like Google and Facebook. Among others, Facebook, of course, has these military origins ties to Peter Thiel, who, you know, obviously has ties to Elon Musk going back as well. But Peter Thiel's ties to the CIA are really obvious by looking through Palantir and also his early connections to Richard Perle, who had him set up Palantir, helped him set up Palantir, basically, who, again, was associated with PNAC and all of this stuff. And then the Google people. Google being sort of facilitated in a lot of ways and funded by the CIA in its early days. And now they have, you know, near total control of the quote unquote infosphere, specifically Google, you know, through search and YouTube, and then social media, Facebook and Twitter, obviously, you know, are very easily brought to heel by the national security community and have a lot of ties to them, or in the case of Twitter to, you know, the Democrats. Specifically the DNC and things like that. So it's definitely, you know, it's basically like the, you know, from 2000 on, they set it up. So the infosphere at some point would, you know, the internet would look free and like an international commons, but they ultimately control it. Right.
Of course.
And the third point here, because there were three missions, so I just read off the first two. The third one's really interesting because it shows why Space Force wasn't made until several years, you know, decades really after this document was authored. They says there needs to be a two-stage strategy for transforming conventional forces. So first, the process will have two stages: transition, featuring a mix of current and new systems. And this was basically having the Missile Defense Agency collaborating with the Air Force developing further its space, you know, systems and all of this stuff, and the Space Command of the Pentagon and all of this. And then the second phase is true transformation, featuring new systems, organizations, and operational concepts, which, of course, we are now in that true transformation phase with the creation of Space Force. And in 2018, there was also the creation of the Army Futures Command. And a lot of these different parts of the military, like the Defense Innovation Unit, that basically is a fusion of the defense community in Silicon Valley, and all of this stuff. I mean, we're really in that phase of true transformation now. People would say for better or for worse. I would say for worse, because it's all just very Orwellian. And disturbing technology, and a lot of it is actually transhumanist as it relates to soldiers. There's a facility that's opening, or I believe it's already opened, and I think Natwick, Massachusetts, that's all about using transhumanist tech and soldiers to get them to talk telepathically through technological means, and to direct machines with their thoughts and all of this stuff. We are really entering a really crazy new phase, and this was all really, if you think about it, charted out by the same neocons that, you know, in your opinion and also in mine, brought us 9/11 in a bunch of crazy wars that have killed millions of people, among other awful things. So do we really want them to have these capabilities? I think not. But, you know, that's just my opinion.
I'm just astonished thinking back to how Matt Taibbi, one of our favorite people, wrote a chapter in his book saying that anybody's fixation on the phrase "a new Pearl Harbor" in this document was just a total lunatic conspiracy theorist, that when you put it in context, he said, it's completely innocuous. It's totally harmless. It's just like all these other think tank papers. What you've just said, Whitney, shows that that's 100% false, what Matt Taibbi is saying.
Yeah,
how could he, as a journalist, lie like that? I mean, that's a straight up lie. This is one of the most crazy documents ever written by any neocon. I mean, you're laying it all right there. And how crazy is this too, Whitney? What's the most mentioned adversarial country in that document? By a factor of about two, it is China. This was written in 2000. Now what's happening? Who is being blamed for our internet being locked down and our censorship? It's that the ChaiComs are influencing Silicon Valley, or that Silicon Valley is bowing to the ChaiComs, the Chinese government, like Peter Thiel is going out there saying right now. I mean, so it just really goes to show how this is, all these pieces are sort of interlocking, and this is a really sophisticated long-term propaganda campaign in a lot of ways. And this UFO thing, in an odd way, fits perfectly into this. I mean, it's just, I don't know. Sorry.
The first point you said about, you know, Matt Taibbi, and there's other people too like this. I know Aaron Matei has made his view on 9/11 truthers really clear, and I think some other people at the gray zone have also said something similar. And I think there's a few other prominent people in independent media as well who've taken the stance that they refuse to engage with 9/11 truthers. They're totally crazy, and all of this stuff. And I think that's a really damaging narrative. And I think it's quite odd that these people would still hold onto that claim, or that belief rather, so firmly, you know, like 20 years after the fact, when clearly so much of what this document laid out has come or is coming to pass. And it makes it really difficult, in my opinion, to explain the realities that not just the U.S., but like the world has experienced as a result of what happened after 9/11. It's hard to explain it as being, as having been, you know, the official narrative, which really, if you critically look at the official narrative, it doesn't hold up to water. And even the 9/11 Commission chairs wrote a whole book about how they were stonewalled by the Pentagon. They were lied to by the Pentagon and the intelligence community. There were key questions that they couldn't answer. It's not a complete report. So they're basically saying it was never fully investigated, the people of the 9/11 Commission. So how can you just completely shit on people that still have questions when they're actually, you know, the people that supposedly were in charge of the quote unquote official investigation say there was no real official investigation? I just think that's dishonest in a sense. But I think, you know, it comes from this careerist perspective that in order to be taken seriously, I guess, by mainstream circles, you have to toe the official line on certain things, 9/11 being one of those. But that really needs to lose its stigma after 20 years. I really think it's time, because we're not going to be able to realize what's going on now if we can't, you know, reckon with that event and the nature of how that event transpired, and how a lot of those people that were responsible for that are still very influential in policy circles today. It's just nuts.
And I'll just ask the audience a basic question. If we're just weighing, you know, the idea that that aliens are here and that they fly an aircraft that, you know, can move faster than anything we've ever seen and has like no friction, and it moves around like a cartoon, is that more crazy to believe, or is the idea that people in the government that were involved in 9/11 more crazy to believe? Yeah. So the idea that 60 Minutes is now reporting basically on the former and taking it seriously, the things have shifted quite dramatically. So the idea now that people in our government were involved in 9/11, it's honestly, overall, it's really on the scale of craziness, it's pretty far down the list in terms of like compared to what mainstream media is talking about now. So I think that's really actually kind of a positive thing, because, you know, all this sort of oddly ties together. You know, rebuilding America's defenses probably talked about this idea of militarizing space in a think tank document more than anybody else I know of from that time period. I mean,
it's like
really
10 pages. It's like one of the main sections, and it's the section with the new Pearl Harbor stuff.
It's amazing.
They call for a new Pearl Harbor, and they talk about control of the internet and information technology and control of space. And, you know, I think that's really relevant because a lot of people, even people in the 9/11 truth community that have been on PNAC and talk about them all the time and talk about this document, I think have sort of missed that link between the new Pearl Harbor quote and this this push to militarize space and also this push to militarize and dominate information technology, Silicon Valley, and, you know, I like that they use the term infosphere because it's very telling, the flow of information, you know, by having it just be so online and, you know, in the virtual world makes it easier for them to control than print, I think, in a lot of ways. And they've sort of led us into these, you know, digital corrals for sharing information that they ultimately control. And that's why a lot of people in independent media have been, you know, scrambling to look for alternative platforms and all of this stuff. But I think at the end of the day, a lot of that infrastructure was intentionally set up and controlled by these people because they've been planning this a really long time. So, you know, I think, you know, Matt Taibbi and saying that this document is, you know, in casting the new Pearl Harbor quote itself is innocuous, he's basically sort of discrediting the importance of this document as a policy document that shaped so much of the past 20 years or so. You know, even if you want to discount the new Pearl Harbor connection or potential connection to September 11th, you know, the document itself is very, very, very relevant to what has gone on in the past, in the decades since. And I think it definitely warrants a lot more attention than it's received even from people that, you know, believe the official 9/11 story. But I mean, even to... it's just really frustrating to me to put like the whole 9/11 truth movement, just like lump them all together. Because I mean, there's people that think the U.S. government was directly involved and there's people that think the U.S. government let it happen. I mean, there's a range of belief there. And there's just people that think it just wasn't investigated properly. And even the 9/11 commission chairs have said that is appropriate. You know, my personal opinion is that people from the U.S. government were involved, and there was also involvement from Israeli intelligence and Saudi intelligence and Pakistani intelligence and potentially other intelligence agencies of the U.S. That's my personal opinion. But of course, you know, there are people that have more, quote unquote, acceptable opinions to the mainstream, and that can't even be entertained by people like Matt Taibbi. I find that disconcerting, to be frank. I don't want to focus on that too much.
Well, it is really interesting, Whitney, that let's just say that this locking down cyberspace is sort of an outcropping of this, you know, just this overall strategic plan that the state, that the U.S. government on some level wants to have control of the internet, but, you know, insidiously and cleverly, I might add, they don't want to make it appear that they do. They want to make it appear that it's being done through other means, you know, that these companies are having to get rid of conspiracy theories and fight disinformation. And we got to fight Russians on the internet now with these troll farms. There's all these different fake reasons that they've come up with to make it seem organic why the internet is being locked down. We know it's not. We know it on a gut level that this was obviously intended. This is the direction things were going to probably go in. And it's also fascinating, too, that this UFO thing, you know, is being pumped up by mainstream media right after they've sort of cleared the playing field of all the like genuine, real people who are dabbling with conspiracies, including, you know, I don't like the QAnon community. I think they're mostly just total con artists, but even including them, they just like cleaned the slate. And I just find that absolutely fascinating. We can't ignore that that's coming off the heels of that. you know, the UFO stuff is just, it's like a, just a few months after they did this giant QAnon purge. I mean, and then the guy who supposedly, oddly, Whitney, Ron Watkins, who's been identified as a potential person who was posting as Q, is now all about UFOs and has a new website all about UFO leaks. So just the whole thing is just oddly connected in this bizarre way.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm really glad you brought up that point earlier about how now it's okay to talk about aliens and UFOs, but questioning the 9/11 narrative is still not okay. I mean,
yeah.
Wow. I mean, what a way to frame it. I mean, that should be a tweet. That's just so telling. I don't know. But some people are really invested in that narrative. Anyway, in the interest of time, I'd want to go back to rebuilding America's defenses, because there's some really crazy quotes in here. And I recommend reading that whole section for people that are interested. Yeah. I'm just going to read some parts of it. So under a subheading that says space and cyberspace, the first paragraph's pretty interesting. Their justification for it. They say, no system of missile defense can be fully effective without placing sensors and weapons in space. Although this would appear to be creating a potential new theater of warfare. In fact, space has been militarized for the better part of four decades. And then they say, like, weather, communications, navigation, and reconnaissance satellites are all increasingly essential elements of U.S. military power. Indeed, U.S. armed forces are uniquely dependent upon space. And then it says a 1996 Joint Strategy Review concluded space is already inextricably linked to military operations on land, on the sea, and in the air. And then the report of the 1997 National Defense Panel, which, by the way, was also responsible for the pivot to homeland security in the lead up to 9/11, agreed unrestricted use of space has become a major strategic interest of the U.S. And on from there, it talks about how space commerce is a growing part of the global economy, and how even back in 1996, commercial launches into space of satellites, I guess, were exceeding military launches. And commercial revenues exceeded government expenditures on space. And in there, they talk about this need for, I guess, what people would call today a public-private partnership between the military and commercial companies, just because of cost effectiveness. But they go on to say many of these commercial space systems have direct military applications, including information from global positioning system constellations and better than 1 meter resolution imaging satellites. And then they talk about how 95% of current US military communications are carried on commercial circuits. And then let's see. Talks about how U.S. military adversaries are poised to catch up, and there's no way this can happen. And they cite prominent military officials saying space control is not an avoidable issue. It is not an optional extra, and that it's essential to be able to have freedom of operations in the space medium, and also deny others the use of space, not just for military purposes, but also, it says later, a space command also recognizes the U.S. must also have the capability to deny America's adversaries the use of commercial space platforms in times of crises and conflicts. Which is pretty interesting, because, you know, crises and conflicts, it can be used quite broadly and vaguely at times. So, you know, what if that applies to any country under U.S. sanctions for any reason? They're not allowed to have satellites or something like that. The way they're framing this is, of course, quite quite concerning. And they use the term over and over again, international commons for space, but they make it pretty clear that they don't want to share it with the international community. They want the U.S. to control it in the near term and also the long term. And, you know, they have a whole section in here on space control. And they talk a lot about in here the need, what I mentioned earlier, I'm not going to go into it too much, the need to create a separate space force to facilitate better transformation, their opinion, of the U.S. military, because it would foster competitiveness within the ranks or something along those lines. And of course, then they talk about the cyberspace issue with it, which they also refer to net war, meaning internet war. And that's interesting that now, as a parallel to this UFO narrative, we're also seeing the great increase of cyber attacks, the cyber attack narrative, which, of course, is a lot of that is attributed the blame is attributed to Russia, China, a lot of the same countries. And that is almost exclusively done either by the intelligence community itself or by quote unquote cybersecurity companies that more often than not were created either by the CIA or Israel's Unit 8200. I've reported on this a lot in my work. So it's interesting to see that both of those things, this push for militarization of space under the guise of UFOs and the net war, the internet war, and the cyberspace war with cyber attacks and all of this stuff supposedly between nation states are both kicking off at the same time, not that long after the creation of Space Force. It's pretty pretty telling, I would say. But, you know, maybe that's conspiratorial or something. Oh, man.
No, I mean, it's like you can no longer. I really do think that the Overton windows move so much that if 60 Minutes and Barack Obama are talking about UFOs, then nobody should be worried anymore about sounding too crazy for just talking about these deep state things, you know, that are very grounded in fact. I mean, there's so many credible things within 9/11 truth. We're doing some speculation about if the neocons were involved or not. You know, some of the things they said seems like they had a lot of foreknowledge, but like there's so many other things that really do paint a picture that, you know, something was very wrong and they completely lied to us about what happened. I mean, there's a lot of facts out there to show that it's not just what we're talking about with the neocons. So,
Mm-hmm.
And just, like, speaking of some people who have sort of piggybacked on this new UFO thing, like Tucker Carlson is sort of out there acting like this is a threat. And he's sort of trying to push, increase the fear about it and acting like, why aren't more people, you know, scared about this or alarmed by this? And he's been really on that. And I think that's maybe a hint as to what this is supposed to do, maybe. But then Sagar on Jetty of The Hill or Breaking Points, whatever their new show is called, is actually saying, no, this isn't China or Russia. This isn't. He's making videos explicitly saying this isn't to increase the budget for Space Force. This isn't propaganda. This is real. And we need to start taking this seriously. So it's interesting that Tucker and his narrative is sort of coalescing, and that actually some of the people who are originally involved in getting this kind of started in the first place, some of these people who appeared on Joe Rogan, specifically this filmmaker, and his name escapes me right now, because this sort of started to bubble up on Joe Rogan for the past year and a half. That guy's been promoting Tucker and Sagar and Jetty, like on social media. So it's odd that that's his, that he prefers to promote their stuff about it.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Well, I don't know if all my listeners know that much about Sagar and Jetty's background, but for people that don't know, he's a fellow at the Hudson Institute, where Scooter Livy, I think, is, I think was he's vice fellow. President. Oh, was it? Oh, he left recently. Yeah. Okay. Well, he only also studied at the, you know, IDF Mossad University and got some certificate there too at IDC Harris Leah or whatever. So, you know, take that guy with as much credibility as you want, I guess, but he's certainly not a progressive or whatever.
Populist.
Yeah. Populist, whatever. Anyway, and to bring up Tucker again, he recently had on this guy that you mentioned earlier, Luis Elizondo. And in that interview with Tucker, which I think was pretty recent, it was like in April of this year, he said that the if the UFO report that's, you know, this Pentagon intelligence community report, if it doesn't highlight how UFOs are a major threat to U.S. national security, it will be an intelligence failure on the scale of 9/11.
Holy
so that's a
shit.
Pretty intense quote. And he says that right on the off. I mean, and it's also on the YouTube description. It's like a one sentence description and they put the 9/11 thing in there. They really liked that line.
Wow.
I think that's pretty telling.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just so fascinating because it's like Tucker and Sagar and these sort of populists have made it appear that they're like against the mainstream media elite.
Well, they're like neocon populists. Yeah.
And they mock, you know, they mock the mainstream media for saying that the Capitol riots were like 9/11, as they rightfully should. So they gain some credibility and trust that way. But then Tucker uses that rhetoric to describe pushing this. So it's just kind of fascinating the way that happens. It's I don't know. I'm just going off on.
Well, no worries. The last thing I wanted to touch on really quick is, that point that rebuilding America's defenses brings up about commercial partners. For people that don't know, of course, SpaceX is the big contractor. They have another one, but they're the main contractor to U.S. Space Force and military space operations. They've won several multi-million dollar contracts, since 2020, and have just been racking up more and more. There was one, they won $160 million one, in March, and, have been just racking them up, pretty much all year long. It's pretty concerning. And they talk about how they want to use, really recently, actually on June 4th, want to use Elon Musk's SpaceX's Starship to deliver cargo around the world. And basically it's SpaceX being the partner there. But if you actually look into SpaceX, a lot of even mainstream media, when it first came around and first started to become like known to people, and Elon Musk started to become sort of a prominent figure, they compared it a lot and noted the parallels of its business model and what it aims to do, specifically with Starlink, to a company that existed before that was called Teledesic. And that company was actually started by this basically the Seattle telecom executive who sold the network he started to AT&T, and Bill Gates. They co-invested together, and this was their thing, and they were going to try and make the world's biggest data network and an internet that blanketed the whole planet. They called it the internet in the sky. And actually there's this document from the Air War College from 1999, that calls it the most ambitious of ventures with great potential utility to the Department of Defense, and all of this stuff, and how the title of the paper, sorry for missing that, was Military Dependence on Commercial Satellite Communication Systems, Strength or Vulnerability. And they talk about Teledesic over and over again. And Teledesic was actually partnered with Boeing, which it was going to be the main contractor for it. And, you know, they, of course, have deep ties to the U.S. military and are military contractors themselves. But Teledesic ended up folding for various reasons in 2002. And that's actually when SpaceX was created. By Elon Musk, sort of to pick up the pieces in a way of that same project. And if you followed my work on Bill Gates and Jeffrey Epstein, Elon Musk, along with a lot of other prominent Silicon Valley figures, like Jeff Bezos, for example, and also the Google co-founders, were intimately involved in the Edge Foundation and Edge Foundation event dinners, which were basically fronts for Epstein. Basically, he funded almost all of Edge. The guy that founded it, John Brockman, ran Ghislaine Maxwell's websites. in addition, it was on the same like a server or something as the Edge Foundation websites and stuff. I mean, really crazy stuff. And Elon Musk, of course, allegedly introduced Mark Zuckerberg to Epstein. Jeffrey Epstein got in with Kimball Musk, Elon Musk's brother, and got tours of SpaceX facilities, allegedly, among other things. And of course, Epstein has considerable ties to Bill Gates, as I kind of exposed recently. So they're definitely part of the same network of intelligence linked and potentially compromised Silicon Valley oligarchs. And of course, Peter Thiel, definitely in that space as well, though he seems to be managing more the terrestrial surveillance, I guess you could say, operations with Palantir and some of these AI weapon startups. He backs like Anduril, among others. But I think it's really disturbing what I mentioned earlier, that Starlink plan, which was also originally Teledesic's plan with military potential, admitted by the DOD to basically, they say, and this is from this a CNET article on SpaceX. The headline is "How SpaceX Starlink Broadband Will Envelop the Earth." I mean, they're like very open about it, basically blanketing the whole planet in low orbit satellites. Amazing. That can beam internet down, but also use that for, you know, surveillance capabilities, spying on everything, sending all these crazy space weapons anywhere, blowing up anything. And they want, you know, total control over this, you know, quote unquote, international commons. There's total planetary domination. I mean, it's basically like the building of the Death Star, for lack of a better analogy. But instead of creating like, you know, some orb floating in space that can like laser any point, it's literally surrounding the planet in those weapons, And it's really disturbing. And I think it's no coincidence either that you have people at the forefront of this. By the way, Amazon also is trying to get in with the Space Force contracts and military space contracts. But you have Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk at the forefront of this. Oh yeah, we're going to travel into space. Like Jeff Bezos has the Blue Origin commercial space thing where, you know, he's going to go into space with his brother and Piero Omidyar and all of these guys. Oh, how cool. Sounds fun. And then, you know, Elon Musk is like, we're going to build colonies on Mars. And, you know, all these like, you know, kids, I guess, think he's really cool because he tweets memes and whatever, you know. So they've worked really hard to, like, you know, sort of capitalize, not necessarily on the alien UFO thing, but it's a similar phenomenon where people are like attracted to that because of sci-fi and other stuff. Mm-hmm. And you know, these same figures responsible for this militarization of space stuff that are basically building this giant, you know, technological hell prison in space around the planet, you know, are basically being like, well, what we're doing is actually cool and sci-fi.
Elon Musk sort of brought back this whole idea of like a renegade billionaire who's like, you know, Richard Branson was almost presented that way in like the 90s.
Yeah,
remember that? They tried to sell him that way. And it's like now when you look back on that, it's like obviously that was a fucking like PR campaign, like fake thing they tried to do. But Elon Musk somehow passed people's bullshit detectors and people believe that he is. And he's basically made people kind of like injected this idea of like sci-fi optimism, like excitement again in people's view of these technologists, Silicon Valley, you know, people and what they're capable of, which before he came around, people were getting increasingly creeped out about what was out there. And even though he acts like things are creepy there, he's so like sort of, you know, cool about it or whatever, that it's like people think you're still like excited. It's like they're not, there's a weird people's guard has gone down about like Silicon Valley people are actually up to.
Yeah, totally. And he has really good PR instead of Silicon Valley in general. I mean, the whole myth of Silicon Valley is, oh, these were guys just tinkering in their garage and look at all the stuff they made, when almost all of them had NQTEL funding from the CIA or some other sort of national security influence on their founding. Right. So it's not exactly guys tinkering in their garage. And if you look at Elon Musk's career, there's no way this guy's a rogue billionaire. He's gotten like, I think it's more than $4 billion in subsidies. And that was like in 2015. So it's probably more now, like from the government to keep his businesses afloat. And a lot of them, if they were actually like subjected to the business models and realities that most businesses in the United States are subjected to, they would not exist. And a lot of, you know, I mean, Tesla cars have been just racked with problems, and SpaceX stuff too. I mean, Tesla cars, they explode all the time. The SpaceX stuff explodes all the time. I mean, you know, people are like, I guess his defenders are like, oh, it's so innovative. Well, of course there's going to be mistakes, but like the guy doesn't follow a regular business model. So he's not a rogue billionaire. Someone's footing the bill and someone made him that wealthy from businesses that wouldn't normally generate, that haven't generated that much revenue without obvious and documented support from the US government. So I just want to make that clear to people. He's not a rogue guy at all.
But Whitney, he's selling flamethrowers and trucks that are indestructible to like, you know.
Okay,
like,
but trucks that are indestructible. I mean, did you not see the promo of that where the guy threw like a ball at the at the window and it like cracked immediately?
Like, yeah, it didn't break through. He's like all like, he's still like proud of it because he said it was supposed to just like, it was going to shatter but not break through. That was his rationalization.
Oh man. Yeah. Okay. So I don't know. People like buy the whole PR thing and, you know, oh, he's a billionaire that tweets memes and all this stuff. But I mean, no, dude, none of these Silicon Valley billionaires are your friends. They all like want to upload their brains into the cloud and live forever. And they're all transhumanist, like crazy people, honestly. And they're really into like gene editing and like Peter Thiel, like is obsessed with, he has a startup with like injecting you with young people blood to make you young and all this stuff. I mean, these people are nuts. And they're not like rogue and cool. And also Peter Thiel is not a libertarian. He is like a Mencius mold bugger, all about, you know, this, this like authoritarian, basically a monarchy, a single leader ruling over the U.S. It's like not libertarian at all. That's like authoritarian military dictatorship. If you actually look at his beliefs, and even like prominent libertarian magazines like Reason, last year did a whole piece about how Peter Thiel, there's no way he's a libertarian. So like, you know, they've tried to frame him as such, and there's been a huge effort. You mentioned Joe Rogan. I mean, that whole circuit of podcasts similar to him have had a lot of Thiel adjacent people on there to promote them as cool, or this whole intellectual dark web thing, you know, that went on. Not that everyone associated with that is bad necessarily, but it's sort of to normalize a lot of these people linked to Peter Thiel, or that are, you know, who's Palantir's a CIA front, and a lot of what Peter Thiel does is a CIA front too. And it's been done to make them look, a lot more, you know, legitimate and cool, and they're rogue and they're not part of the system. Well, actually, Peter Thiel set up all his crap with Richard Perle. So it's, they are the neocons. They're just the new face of the neocons, but they've, you know, gone about this in such a way to make themselves look cool and look counterculture when they're really not. And I think people need to start getting wise to that. You know, hopefully Unlimited Hangout, we have plans to do a lot more articles on that, specifically on what I like to call the Thielverse, and also Elon Musk and some of these other Silicon Valley figures as it relates to Epstein and some other things in the future, because it's really, they really need to stop being, you know, this PR that's been built around them of these cool billionaires, and they're rogue and they want to make the world a better place with technology and all this stuff. It's crap. You know, it's just a continuation of the same people, or rather the same groups that have been driving this agenda for decades, and they really need to be, you know, shown to be part of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think just the classic concept of controlled opposition. A lot of these,
yeah, for real,
media figures that act like they're anti-establishment and, you know, anti-deep state or anti the mainstream media, anti-war, even. A lot of them are part of some weird network that's being artificially signal boosted by, you know, just like, you know, two sides of the same coin, as they used to say. It's just, it does seem like we're being played. And this UFO thing, you know, does seem, I mean, on some level we are being played by it. It's just hard to know exactly how and for what purpose we're being
played. Yeah, exactly.
I think hypersonic weapons, new arms race, dominating space are clearly on the agenda, and they fit in perfectly with these blueprints that we had written in the, you know, early 2000s.
Yeah, I absolutely agree, and I think that's a really good spot to end it, because I know you have to go, Robbie. So if you could let listeners know where they can follow your stuff and what you're working on right now, that would be great.
Well, you can follow our podcast, Media Roots Radio, that I do with Abby Martin, and that's comes out 4 times a month at patreon.com/MediaRootsRadio. Right now we're doing this really sort of elaborate deep dive history podcast that's only for our Patreon subscribers. You could donate $5 a month and get access to it. But it's about the Freemasonic history of the United States. And we're up to episode 7 now. And it's probably going to continue, you know, at least 3 to 4 more parts. So that's what I've been mostly working on right now. And just, we just did a podcast sort of exposing the Hudson Institute and, Cigar on Jetty and the weird school, you know, the counterterrorism, diploma or whatever he got from that school in Israel, and that kind of stuff. So, yeah. And thank you for having me on again, Whitney. It's always a pleasure. Come on.
Yeah.
Limited Hangout.
Absolutely. I mean, you're one of my favorite people to have on. You always have really great and insightful stuff to say, and this was no exception. So thank you. And with that being said, thank you all for tuning in to this episode of Unlimited Hangout. I'm hoping to have episodes more frequently this month, because I couldn't do as much last month. So look for that. I'm hoping to have Sam Husseini and some other people on in the coming week. So I'll be talking about that on Twitter, Rockfin, and other places where you can follow my work, like Telegram as well. So thanks for tuning in, and catch you all next time.